Colombia's image is still tainted by its long and violent drug war, but its second-largest city is now becoming known for an innovative form of budgeting. As Alex Schmidt reports, residents of Medellin have a direct say over how tax dollars are spent.
26-year-old John Jaime Sanchez grew up in the hills of Medellin under the legacy of Pablo Escobar's violent drug cartel.
The militias iban al colegio, a la institución educativa.
Militias would come to our school and tell us we had to take up arms to make revolution, to change how we were living. I liked the idea that we needed to find a solution to change things, but what I didn't believe is that we needed to do it with violence.
So Sanchez started a music group called Son Bata. Over the years, Son Bata has grown from a band into a social service force against the crushing poverty of his neighborhood. Ramshackle homes pile on top of each other and open sewers pour down nearly vertical streets. Son Bata's colorful cultural center stands out. Hundreds of children find an escape here through free music classes, and working musicians from the slums get help finding performing jobs. Ingrid Joana Jaramillo works at Son Bata.
For me, it's everything. Son Bata is my life. When I started being part of Son Bata is when I started to dream.
Part of what's helped the group is Medellin's process of participatory budgeting. It divides the city up into small neighborhoods. Residents allocate part of the city budget to health centers, college scholarships, and youth music groups that have sprung up in Medellin. John Jaime Sanchez gets 30% of his operating budget through the system.
With participatory budgeting, Son Bata has contracted with professors. We bought instruments. We are creating a music studio.
Participatory budgeting originated in Porto Alegre, Brazil, in 1989. Medellin is one of the largest cities in the world to have successfully adopted it. It's 5% of the city budget. Sanchez says it's not enough to make deep structural changes, but by most measures, the system here has been a success. Alberto Díaz-Calleros of the University of California at San Diego has been studying the ways such systems take root in Mexico. He says there's not a lot of research about it, but he knows that historical factors have to be just right, like they were in Medellin.
This happened in an environment of a city which was the most violent in Latin America, in a deep crisis, where a mayor that had no connection to any of the established political parties came in with a completely new vision about how to run local government.
That mayor, Sergio Fajardo, is now running for governor of the Colombian state of Antioquia. He worries that another challenge remains, keeping citizens engaged.
In the communities, they may get tired of saying, oh, once again, we have to go and discuss with these guys who are boring or so. So you have to make sure that you mix things up. You keep the flame alive.
For musician John Jaime Sanchez, at least, the flame shows little sign of fading.
Participatory budgeting is a very valuable way for youth to understand how, with a resource, I can try to solve the problems of my community.
The budgeting process didn't create Sanchez's group. Son Bata existed a year before it even came into effect, but it did make city money easier to get for him and dozens of youth music groups in Medellin. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
This week, the rating agency Standard & Poor's lowered its credit outlook for the U.S. government. It was a warning about the size of the deficit, and the agency said it might downgrade the country's stellar credit rating. Well, that announcement, of course, made headlines around the world. Global stock markets fell. To talk more about the influence of rating agencies like Standard & Poor's, we've called Jacob Goldstein from NPR's Planet Money team in New York. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
So let me start by asking, why does a statement like this from S&P send such jitters through the markets? I mean, it is not as if everyone didn't know the U.S. has a problem with the size of its deficit.
Yeah, we definitely saw a sharp fall in the stock market after this came out. And certainly the sort of news narrative we heard was stock markets fall on S&P warning. I don't know exactly why that happened. You know, you could say, well, people were nervous and this made them more nervous. You could sort of construct a complicated story that says, well, if there were a downgrade, interest rates go up, that would be bad for companies. That would drive stocks down. But I actually think one really interesting place to look is at the bond market, right? Because bond investors, after all, they're the ones lending money. money to the U.S. government, right? But if you look at what happened to the bond market after this warning came out, it was almost nothing. There was essentially no effect. So at least as far as bond investors are concerned, this warning was no big deal.
And why should we pay attention, generally speaking, to pronouncements from S&P or the other rating agencies, the other big two being Moody's and Fitch? I mean, they turned out to be incredibly inaccurate in the financial crisis. Lots of mortgage-related bonds that they rated very highly turned into junk. Why trust them?
That's a great question. They certainly got a black eye in the financial crisis. But despite whatever their performance may have been, the big ratings agencies, they're still written into the laws and the regulations that govern our financial system. So, for example, if rating agencies lower their rating, that can force banks and insurance companies and other big financial firms to sell off that country's bonds. So the rating agencies still do matter.
You say that their influence is written into the law, but these are not government agencies. How is it exactly that they work?
They're private companies, and when they rate corporate bonds and mortgage bonds, it's actually the companies that they're rating that's paying them. So it is this very strange hybrid, right? On the one hand, they're private, they make a profit, but on the other hand, the law gives them this special position in the financial system.
What happens if events that they're warning about come true and the U.S. should come to lose its AAA rating? What would that actually mean?
That could actually be quite significant. You know, U.S. Treasury debt is widely considered still among the safest investments in the world. Lots of big firms and countries even put their money in treasuries the way you or I would just put our money in the bank. So if they actually did get downgraded, if S&P said, you know what, there are other safer places to put your money, one simple thing that might happen is the U.S. government would have to spend more money paying interest. Borrowers would demand higher interest rates to lend money to the government. Another thing that might happen more broadly, you could see other countries assuming a more prominent role in the sort of global financial system, the U.S. kind of fading a little bit and other big countries rising.
All right, Jacob, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jacob Goldstein. He's with NPR's Planet Money team in New York.
President Obama is taking his deficit reduction plan on the road. Today, he holds a town hall meeting at Facebook headquarters in Palo Alto, California. Yesterday, he was in Virginia answering questions from voters. NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
President Obama was at Northern Virginia Community College to spread the word that he had a plan to control the deficit by cutting spending, protecting Medicare, and raising taxes on the rich. He said he was sure, despite their differences, he could forge a compromise with the Republicans, since both sides already agreed to cut about $4 trillion over 10 years.
The big question that is going to have to be resolved is, how do we do it? And there is, I don't want to lie to you, there is a big philosophical divide right now. I believe that you've got to do it in a balanced way. I believe that you've got to, yes, have spending cuts, but you can't cut things like education or basic research or infrastructure down to the bone.
The debt and deficit are the number one preoccupation inside Washington, but that's not always true outside the Beltway. At the Annandale Town Hall, like a lot of other places, it was gas prices and energy. Mitchell Holloman is a computer engineering student who came to hear the president.
I'm really concerned about the clean energy solutions because with the deficit that we have, most of those solutions and alternatives are far more expensive than the things that we have in place now. So how are we going to reduce the deficit and at the same time, develop clean energy alternatives?
The president has been touring the country touting investment in clean energy technology as a long-term solution to high gas prices. But in the short term, there's very little he can do. There's no single silver bullet, he said.
And if you're driving out of necessity 50 miles a day to work, and you can't afford to buy some fancy new hybrid car, so you're stuck with the old beater that is getting you 8 miles a gallon, that's pretty frustrating. Now, I wish I could tell you that there was some easy, simple solution to this.
That wasn't good enough for Neil Barrientos, a radiology student.
We're spending so much money on gas, and you see it going up and up and up and up, and, you know, when is it going to stop? But what I would have liked to have heard was more about what exactly is he going to do about the gas prices and how is he going to stop that.
Kulsum Faisal, a biology major, wasn't satisfied either. She expects the president to do something about gas prices now.
Government should enforce the gas prices and make sure, you know, California, it's like $4.20, and like here, it's like, you know, a little bit lower. And it's like different all across the country. So he should make sure, you know, it's lower.
But Dennis Shanta, a nursing student who's graduating in 2 weeks, is more sympathetic.
There is no easy solution. Other, you can dump money into research to try and come up with alternative fuels, but then that's money that really could be used for Medicare or Medicaid. You could, you know, allow more offshore drilling, but then we just went through that whole horrible situation in the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes you're in a catch-22 situation where no matter what you decide, there's going to be something that is not beneficial on the other end of that decision, so can't hold him responsible.
President Obama, who begins his re-election campaign with an approval rating under 50%, can only hope more voters are as forgiving as that. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. While the nation's unemployment rate remains stubbornly high, at least one national company is on a hiring spree. McDonald's attempted to recruit up to 50,000 new employees in a single day yesterday. It's not unusual for franchises to fill thousands of jobs quickly, especially in the spring. But as NPR's Joel Rose reports, McDonald's is also trying to change the perception of what it means to work for the company.
It's lunchtime, and there's barely anywhere to sit in the dining room at a McDonald's restaurant in the Parkside section of West Philadelphia, but most people aren't here to eat.
Hi, how you doing? Sign in right here for me, please. Somebody else can sign in right there.
They've got pens in hand, filling out job applications.
We've had over 400 applicants in the first 4 hours.
John Dawkins owns this McDonald's franchise and 8 others in Philadelphia.
I think it's a sign of the economic times that people are saying, wait a minute, I might not have considered McDonald's before, but you know what? They're probably a viable option. So let me go down and put in an application.
Whether that's a positive reflection on McDonald's or a negative reflection on the local economy may depend on whom you ask.
When you hear about McDonald's jobs, people tend to just say, no, it's not worth it, but it's definitely worth it.
Joseph McIntosh started out at this franchise as a crew member. That was his first job after spending time in jail for selling drugs. 4 years later, McIntosh is an assistant manager.
What are you hoping to do for this company?
Hopefully become a GM. Right now, I'm assistant to the GM, and hopefully one day they'll possibly let me run my own store.
This is exactly the kind of story McDonald's wants to tell. The company is trying to change the perception of the McJob, defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as an unstimulating, low-paid job with few prospects. That's part of the reason the company held hundreds of open houses on Tuesday as part of National Hiring Day. In West Philadelphia, managers mill around the dining room wearing buttons that say, "Ask me about my McJob" on their suit lapels. Training consultant Eddie Dolce started out as a crew member before working his way up.
You know, you work at McDonald's, it's more than just flipping burgers or working out fries. There's potential for you to come through all the ranks. When I first started out working at McDonald's, first of all, I didn't even want to work for McDonald's. But once I got in and it was explained to me, hey, you know, you can have a career, and 17 years later, I'm still here. So, I mean, there's this opportunity for growth, I mean, all the way to the top, the very top of the corporation.
The president of McDonald's USA, Jan Fields, started out as a crew member. But most of the people filling out applications in West Philadelphia aren't looking to climb into upper management. They're just looking for work, period.
Nobody's hiring right now. It's hard with the economy and everything, you know.
Sheila Harris has been looking for work since she was laid off from another fast food restaurant a year ago. Now she's hoping for a job at McDonald's, a company she's worked for before.
This is one of my first jobs. Actually, 30 years ago, this is one of my first jobs here at McDonald's.
Young people still make up a big part of the McDonald's workforce. Sylvia Bivens is a single mom who's been out of work since November.
Everybody says the same thing. I'd rather flip burgers and be getting paid than not do anything and just not getting paid. And there's a lot of young people in here today. A lot.
And franchise owner John Dawkins concedes that, yes, some of those people will get paid minimum wage or pretty close to it. But he says there's a lot of room to grow at McDonald's if you have what the company likes to call ketchup in your veins.
You mean that as a good thing?
Yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah, it's a real good thing. I have a passion for the business. I love what I do. I love selling hamburgers.
Right now, Dawkins is hoping to find about 100 people with ketchup in their veins, too. Joel Rose, NPR News, Philadelphia.